I'm okay, you're okay. Must be true if Warren Buffett says so, yeah? Where we stand in the global economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, today, the 29th of February. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Not for the first time. I'm going to begin this program with this sentiment. This is a global economy. We just live in it. And while things here are fine, economy-wise, maybe not great, but fine, and more about that in a minute, by the way, but if things here are fine, things elsewhere are decidedly not fine. Exhibit A being the People's Republic of China. It's been 6 or so months now, maybe a little longer, that the economic jitters there have been unsettling the rest of us. And today's news from Beijing brings more of the same. The People's Bank of China has lowered the amount of cash that Chinese banks have to keep in reserve, which will, in theory, free up more cash for loans to consumers who will then, in the same theory, spend it. Beijing is also allowing its currency, the renminbi, it's called, to fall in value just a tiny little bit. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams starts us off with China's latest move to try to settle things down.
China is trying out lots of different strategies to combat a worrying issue. Growth is slowing down. Barry Naughton is a professor of Chinese economy at the University of California, San Diego.
It's slowing down because the growth miracle phase is over. And so handling that kind of a slowdown is really, really difficult for anybody.
Like it was for Japan and South Korea. And it's especially hard, Naughton says, when different factions argue for different solutions. But hey, at least they're all trying. Ann Lee is an adjunct professor at New York University and studies China's economy.
China's policymakers are doing their best to try to ensure that China's economy continues to basically grow at a steady pace, not necessarily as fast as it used to be, but at least it's still a reliable economy.
And that reliability is what the rest of the world wants.
The whole world is worried about devaluation of the Chinese currency.
David Dollar is with the China Center at the Brookings Institution. He says Chinese officials are walking a knife's edge, trying to stimulate growth without setting off a currency slide.
Their game plan was stabilize expectations and that capital outflow, and now make some monetary moves. So, it will be interesting to see if this all works out the way they want.
And China's economy is so linked with the rest of the world, if it doesn't work out, we'll all feel it. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
All right, so about the state of the American economy. You would be forgiven if you only listened to stump speeches and presidential debates if you thought we are all going straight down the tubes. Berkshire Hathaway CEO Warren Buffett, however, says politicians know not whereof they speak. In his annual letter to investors, Buffett was downright optimistic. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson assesses Buffett's assessment.
Warren Buffett wrote that for 240 years, it's been a terrible mistake to bet against America, and now is not the time to start, that American kids will live far better than their parents did, that in an election year, those negative Nancys on the campaign trail, that's my paraphrasing, are getting us all too down about our economic future.
You know, we're all looking at the same data.
Adam Anazildarum is with the conference board.
Perhaps it's where you put more emphasis and how much confidence you have, both in what the data is showing and how much confidence you have in the ability of that American economy.
You can go glass half empty or, like Buffett, glass half full. Robert Johnson, director of economic analysis at Morningstar, says he mostly agrees with Buffett's optimism.
I sit here and say, you know what, everybody's whining, this isn't so bad, it's really not. And I believe that, but on the other hand, this whole struggle, nobody feels safe and comfortable, and I think that's a little bit harder for an economist to put our hands on.
Josh Bivens with the Economic Policy Institute says he's glad politicians are talking about the problems in our economy, that we're still not recovered from the Great Recession, that even before the recession, hourly wage growth was stagnant.
And now if you ask me, will my son be better off than me 30 years from now? The economy is going to be a lot richer, but yet we do such a bad job equitably delivering the fruits of that growth that I'm not sure he'll be better off. If he ends up in the bottom quarter of the income distribution, he may well not be.
He says the U.S. is a rich nation with lots of potential, and it's good for Buffett to remind us of that. But Bivens says the key is for growth everyone can benefit from. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We had Buffett on the program a couple of three, 4 years ago. It should be on our website. Click on that tab over on the left side. Mentioned on air is what it says. There was a moment just before lunchtime on Wall Street today when everything was looking fine, and then it wasn't. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I learned a new phrase today, honorary expenses. It came in the context of a piece in Politico talking about how some of the biggest of the big tech companies in Silicon Valley, and you know who they are trying to change public perceptions of their diversity problems. We've outlined those before, the lack of women and people of color in one of the most innovative parts of the American economy. Tony Rahm had the byline on the story. Tony, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Explain to me how this whole thing works, the honorary expenses and all that.
Sure. There are plenty of ways to lobby here in Washington. You could hire an army of lobbyists and set about canvassing the Capitol. You can spend money on the reelection campaign of lawmakers or presidents or whatever the case may be. Or you can put down what are called honorary expenses. Essentially, companies can spend money on fancy dinners or donations to a member of Congress's charity that honor lawmakers or honor their elected officials, and those expenses have to be reported. When it comes to tech companies, though, a lot of these expenses are going towards minority groups, right, like the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation and the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute, organizations that in recent months and in recent years have really looked at the industry askance because of their hiring records and their poor diversity in their workforces back in Silicon Valley.
Talk to me for a second then about the companies involved. It is, I imagine, the usual suspects.
It is. Apple, Google, Uber, companies like that are playing a greater role in D.C., generally speaking, as they're taking more heat and facing more scrutiny. But they're definitely embracing this honorary expenses strategy.
So give me an example. There's an anecdote in your piece about $1 million dinner that Apple sponsored, a foundation party.
Apple put in more than $1 million for an awards gala from the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. And, you know, while it was part of a larger program put on by Apple as it tries to increase the ranks of African Americans in Silicon Valley, that $1 million, you know, helped convene a dinner where the CIA director and other elected officials were honored. And this is exactly what we're seeing with other tech companies as they try to get closer to minority groups. And many of the regulators are the elected officials that are being honored at these fancy dinners and cocktail receptions and so forth.
You know, it's tempting to look at this and go, ew. But at the same time, first of all, this is kind of the way it works. And second of all, these companies know they have a diversity problem. And I would imagine that their line to you is, we're trying, man.
That's exactly what they're saying. You know, on one hand, this money ultimately goes to organizations and those organizations use it for good purposes. Take the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, for one. That's taken in tens of thousands of dollars from companies like Google for a few years now. Now, if you talk to the CBC, they say, hey, you know, they can give us all the money they want, but we're taking that cash and using it for scholarships and for fellowships, things that actually help African-American students try to get jobs in Silicon Valley. The flip side of that, though, is that companies like Google are spending money on events and gaining access to the regulators. And they're using that opportunity to, you know, to bring their lobbyists and their executives right to the decision makers in D.C. So while the organizations say it's not a form of lobbying, you have others like the Center for Responsive Politics that really see it as a pay-for-play kind of system, a way for companies to get closer to the regulators, even if that cash ultimately helps an organization like the CBC.
Tony Rahm is a senior technology reporter for Politico. Tony, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
One of the really big corporate M&A announcements of last year, which remember was a big year for mergers and acquisitions, was the $120 billion or so get-together of Dow Chemical and DuPont. Those are two of this country's oldest industrial companies with deep roots in the economy, nowhere more so than in West Virginia, Whereas Glynis Board of West Virginia Public Broadcasting reports the corporate has become very personal.
People in West Virginia are worried a huge business merger like Dow-DuPont ultimately will translate to more lost jobs.
Everybody thinks DuPont is still going to be the same company it's always going to be, and it's not.
Chemist Jerry Morcheski worked for DuPont for more than 30 years, but he says he was forced to retire in 2009. The company's presence in West Virginia has been shrinking in the last couple of decades. To date, the state estimates it's the 40th largest private employer in West Virginia. But back in the day, it was in the top five, providing well-paid jobs that didn't require advanced degrees.
There was a time when you didn't talk about DuPont. You just didn't talk about it because they were the largest employer in Wood County.
This is Larry Dale, a school bus driver and a retired preacher in Washington, West Virginia.
Pigtails.
You got pigtails? Oh, very cool.
It's nice to meet you.
My mom's here.
The Dales are having a visit with their granddaughter, Willa.
How about a glass of water filtered?
I would love that.
Okay. I promise it's Brita filtered.
Okay. They're offering me filtered water because they live right next to a DuPont landfill.
If you look out the north side of the house, you can see the rim of the dump. I'm going to call it a dump. They would prefer I probably didn't, but that's what it is. It is a dump.
A decade ago, it came to light that DuPont contaminated municipal water sources in this region with a chemical used to coat nonstick cookware. The company voluntarily agreed to phase out manufacturing and use of the chemical. Last year, an area Ohio resident who developed cancer won a $1.6 million judgment against the company. DuPont plans to appeal, arguing the company acted responsibly. 3,500 similar lawsuits are pending. Again, Larry Dale.
Everybody has kind of considered the DuPont to Dow acquisitions to be a way of either escaping from the corporate responsibility or reinforcing themselves for the liabilities that are out there.
In an email, a company spokesperson said DuPont remains committed to fulfilling all legal and environmental obligations. Despite environmental concerns, many people here would welcome DuPont back. Amid all the uncertainty, there's still hope Dow DuPont could expand business. Ashok Abbott is a professor at West Virginia University's College of Business and Finance.
We should be looking at the next generation of their plants, not the existing facilities.
DuPont retiree Jerry Morcheski, who now lives in Pennsylvania, says times are changing for people in West Virginia. He maintains contact with former colleagues in West Virginia. He says many of those friends are worried about what comes next.
Nothing lasts forever. Things change as we go through, and we have to adjust to them.
Many business leaders in West Virginia and the surrounding region are working hard to find ways to compete with Gulf states for future chemical and plastic industries. And people living in the shadow of these chemical giants today, like Susan and Larry Dale, say if the shadow had a shape, it would be a question mark. In Washington, West Virginia, I'm Glynis Board for Marketplace.
Coming up.
If someone had told me when I was a freshman, this is not a good fit for you, you should probably go, I would have gone.
Don't let the college door hit you in the rear on the way out. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off 123 points today, 0.7%, closed at 16,516. The NASDAQ declined 32 points, also 0.7%, 45,57. The S&P 500 down 15 points, 0.8%. 1932 there. Big jump in the price of crude today. West Texas Intermediate, the U.S. benchmark, that is, up 3% on news that Saudi Arabia is going to work with other oil-producing countries to manage the ongoing volatility in the oil markets. Royal Dutch Shell thus added 1.2%. Chevron, though, gave back 1%. Icahn Enterprises rose 3.75% today after Carl Icahn announced his company wants to buy what's left of Federal Mogul. That's an auto parts maker. Icahn already owns a big chunk of that company. Federal Mogul revved up 45%. This is, by the way, the latest investment in the auto industry for Icahn. Last year, he bought Pep Boys. O'Reilly Auto Parts today shed 1%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.73%. and you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Set your DVRs, everybody. Season 10 of The Voice starts tonight on NBC. Although, I ought to tell you, Gwen Stefani is not going to be there, and she's not the only thing. There are going to be fewer traditional commercials, too, at least tonight. And farther down your programming guide, Viceland, the new cable channel from Vice, debuts today as well. And word is, it's rethinking traditional television advertising, too. Marketplace's Adrian Hill looks at whether any of this experimentation is likely to stick.
NBC will offer up bonus content during some of its shows tonight. During The Voice, they'll check in with last season's winner. During Blind Spot, there'll be a Q&A with the show's creators, all brought to you by American Express. Amanda Lotz is a media professor at the University of Michigan.
It's a recognition of the need for new strategies, or actually really a return to old strategies.
She says the early days of television were built on sponsorships like this one from the credit card company. Viceland, the new cable show from Vice, is also experimenting. Richard Greenfield is a media analyst at BTIG.
And really rethinking what it's like to have sponsors rather than the typical ad model. And that could be a real innovation that is sorely needed in the media industry.
Sorely needed because there are signs that viewers are losing patience with ad after ad after ad after ad. Even so, don't expect a broad rejection of the traditional commercial break.
Well, I think it works.
That's analyst Brian Weiser from Pivotal Research.
The 30-second spot seems to be the balance that works in terms of the relative cost, the relative efficiency, the comparability, across units.
Standard ads, he says, help advertisers keep track of what's succeeding and what isn't, and may earn advertisers even more attention when they do break the mold. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
You remember how last year when the FAA was laying down its rules for drones, it said no thanks to commercial drones flying over populated areas doing things like, I don't know, delivering packages from Amazon or Google? Well, now comes word the agency is putting together a task force to look at letting that happen after all, commercial drones in the skies overhead. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains what that might be like.
Are there going to be pilotless airplanes whizzing through the air, landing in parking lots and backyards to drop off packages soon? You know, like in the Jetsons. Ella Atkins says, probably not at first. It's not possible now because of range. She teaches engineering at the University of Michigan.
If you have a warehouse that's several miles from where you need to deliver the package, can it actually get there?
Most big warehouses are in rural areas. Today, drones can fly about 10 miles. But technology aside, regulation will also limit them. Logan Ilanimi teaches mechanical engineering at the University of Nevada, Reno. He thinks that's probably a good thing.
As of right now, there's almost no accountability. You know, if a drone comes crashing through my window right now, I have no way of tracking down who it is, anything like that.
The government says it's not only about safety, but also privacy. Roger Sullenberger works at 3DR, a big drone maker. He says drones bring up just one of several privacy concerns we have. Cell phones, social media, email, but
drones right now, you know, they look so alien and strange and intimidating, and they've got this camera eye on them that it's a visceral reaction.
So what's the timeline? FAA says developing and validating a regulatory scheme is going to take time because people want to do different things with drones. Google and Amazon say they'll have drone delivery in a couple of years. Logan Ilanimi says 5 is more likely, but the companies are itching to phase out humans because of cost.
Absolutely. Drones tend to be a lot cheaper. They don't require food or health insurance.
I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The big push in higher ed the past, 10 years easy, has been getting more students into college. Increasingly, though, schools are being squeezed to make sure more of those students stick around and finish. It's not just for the tuition dollars either. Freshman retention rates are a factor in those all-important school rankings. And it turns out that about 30% of college students on average don't make it to sophomore year. So from the education desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Marketplace's Amy Scott tells the story of how one Maryland college made headlines, not the good kind, trying to change it.
Mount St. Mary's University sits on a hill in rural Emmitsburg, Maryland. The Catholic college has just under 1,700 undergraduate students and has struggled to keep them. Varunda Patel is a senior from nearby Frederick, Maryland.
We started off as a class of over 480, and now we're at a class of 367. It is an issue.
That's more than 100 students who've left the university, almost a quarter of the entering class. Fellow senior Molly McShalley says some were too far from home or decided college wasn't for them.
A lot of people didn't gel with the small school feel because it's kind of a shock to be here in Emmitsburg in the middle of nowhere with so few students that we have.
Under pressure to fix the falloff, Mount St. Mary's new president, Simon Newman, had a plan. Identify 20 to 25 freshmen who were at risk of dropping out and invite them to leave early with a refund. When faculty members objected, Newman said something the student newspaper got wind of and soon made national headlines. Quote, "You think of the students as cuddly bunnies, but you can't. You just have to drown the bunnies. Put a Glock to their heads." End quote. And Newman wanted this done early, within the first few weeks of the school year.
Before they needed to report statistics on the entering class to the federal government. So this way it would look like they had retained a large percentage of students.
That's John Schwenkler, a philosophy professor at Florida State University, who taught at Mount St. Mary's from 2010 to 13. He says at-risk students would be identified in part through a survey.
The survey would ask things like, how often have you felt depressed? How often have you felt disliked? Is your family facing financial difficulties? And use their responses from this survey to predict who was going to fail.
President Newman, who came to Mount St. Mary's from the private equity world, declined to be interviewed for this story and has since apologized for his comments. But it wasn't just the bunnies that got people upset. The first year of college is hard for a lot of students with all its social and academic adjustments, so much so that there's a whole center at the University of South Carolina dedicated to studying the first year experience. The center's Jennifer Koip says freshman year is the major leakage point in the educational pipeline.
And getting students over that first hurdle is critical to the long-term success.
Koip says there are lots of methods to help freshmen get through. Courses that teach study skills, peer mentoring, dorms where like-minded students live and study together. And Mount St. Mary's has support services like tutoring and counseling and a special committee for at-risk students. Koip says encouraging students to leave should be the last resort.
It's up to us as educators to make sure that we're using any number of different tools to coach a student through and support their success rather than perhaps coaching them out.
Particularly since the students most at risk tend to be the very ones colleges have been working harder to bring in.
The students who are most impacted by these challenges are often from minority backgrounds. They are often low-income students. They're often first-generation college students.
Michelle Asha Cooper is president of the Institute for Higher Education Policy, which focuses on college access and success. She says the situation at Mount St. Mary's shows one potential risk of the intense pressure on colleges to get students through.
Which is then causing more and more people to question whether or not some students should be enrolled in college in the first place.
Grace Wagler is on track to be the first in her middle-class family to get a bachelor's degree. But when she arrived at Mount St. Mary's after having been homeschooled, everything was an adjustment. The food, the rigorous work, living with a roommate.
It wasn't just a struggle for me, it was traumatic. Every day I would call my mom sobbing, "I don't think I can do this."
Wagler says if she had taken that survey her first year, she might have ended up one of the bunnies.
If someone had told me when I was a freshman, this is not a good fit for you, you should probably go, I would have gone.
She got help from a faculty advisor and stuck with it. She's a junior now and hoping the college will be known for more than the bunny scandal by the time she graduates. In Emmitsburg, Maryland, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which the least surprising moment from the Oscars last night, Leonardo DiCaprio winning for The Revenant, does turn out to have made a little bit of news. According to Twitter, Leo's win was the most tweeted Oscar moment ever, 440,000 tweets per minute, which, if you're not on Twitter, is a lot. It beat Ellen DeGeneres' star-studded selfie from a couple of years ago by a mile. Look, I told you it was a little bit of news, all right? Hey, look at the time. Got to go. The Dow off 123 points today, 0.7%. The NASDAQ down 32 points, also 0.7%. The S&P 500 dropped 15 points lower, 0.8% there. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you right back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.